Good evening. Welcome to First Edition here on WEAA 88.9. I am Sean Yoes, your host, editor of the Baltimore Afro-American newspaper. Thank you for joining us for our first of 2 hours on this Wednesday. Support for WEAA is provided by, support for WEAA traffic and MTA report is provided by Sherwin Williams. Coming up in the second hour of the show on this Wellness Wednesday, Kenyatta Moon will be here. She is founder of the Inseroma Academy for Holistic Thought. She is co-host of Holistic Living. Her segment is coming up in the second hour, as well as Lamont Summers. He is assistant professor of media law and ethics here at the School of Global Journalism and Communication. Professor Summers will be here with the media report. Excuse me. I'm certain that the professor will have much to talk about, speak on, as far as the 45th president's speech last night in Phoenix, Arizona. That's all coming up in the second hour of the show. A little bit later in the first hour, the Mod Squad will be here. That is Taya Graham and Stephen Janis of the Real News Network, talking about law enforcement and politics, including public discussions by Governor Larry Hogan, State's Attorney Marilyn Mosby, and Police Commissioner Kevin Davis on the violence that continues to grip our city. That's coming up in the Mod Squad segment. Before we get to the Mod Squad, we're going to open up the phone lines. I don't know how many people saw this speech last night of the 45th president of the United States. But after that speech, that campaign style speech, that bombastic speech, even more people, including Republican lawmakers, are questioning this president's competence, his fitness to be the 45th president, to be president of the United States, to occupy the Oval Office. The question for listeners, and we want you to call in now, you know the number, 410-319-8888, 410-319-8888. We're going to play a couple of excerpts, I believe, from the speech in a moment. But I want to get your insights, your thoughts, your thoughts on the speech that you heard, because I'm sure many of our listeners listened last night as the president rallied in Arizona. What were your thoughts? What are your thoughts about the president's speech or this 45th president's speech? You start to run out of adjectives. We know that he, again, doubled down on much of the rhetoric that he had been spewing about the Charlottesville tragedy, the situation that killed that young woman, Heather Heyer, and injured 19 other people. There have been multiple versions, I guess you could say, from Trump on his, you know, different speeches. First he finds fault with many sides as far as the Charlottesville situation. Then he just condemns the racist and white supremacists. Then he comes back again in a speech from Trump Tower, again condemning many sides in the situation in Charlottesville. And last night during the speech in Arizona, he condemned the white nationalist, but neglected to admit the fact that he used the term, he omitted the line, many sides this time around. Many sides were at fault for the violence that transpired in Charlottesville. So we want to ask the question, and James Clapper, former he's an intelligence specialist, but a former director of the NSA, I believe Clapper is, served several presidents, including Republicans and Democrats, is the latest who has, I believe Clapper is technically a Republican, the latest to suggest that, or not suggest, but argue that the 45th president is indeed unfit to occupy the Oval Office. Earlier, I believe last week, it was Senator Corker of Tennessee, one of the more restrained and respected Republicans in the Senate, to say that he's essentially the 45th president is unfit for service, unfit for service as president of the United States. But we want to hear what our listeners think. The number is 410-319-8888. What did you think about the president's speech? What did you think about Donald Trump's speech? And the question that everybody is, not everybody, but a lot of people are asking, is he fit? Is he not well mentally? This is something that pontificators and commentators and columnists have been talking about and writing about for months now. But the conversation is growing. The conversation is burgeoning. We ask you, our listeners, 410-319-8888, what do you think? What do you think about the president's speech? What do you think about his fitness to occupy the Oval Office? Let's listen to some sound, rambling sound, of Donald Trump's speech in Phoenix, Arizona, and then we'll take phone calls afterwards.
And I mean truly dishonest people in the media and the fake media. They make up stories. They have no sources in many cases. They say a source says there is no such thing, but they don't report the facts. Just like they don't want to report that I spoke out forcefully against hatred, bigotry, and violence, and strongly condemned the neo-Nazis, the white supremacists, and the KKK. I openly called for unity, healing, and love, and they know it because they were all there. So what I did is I thought, I'd take just a second, and I'm really doing this more than anything else, because you know where my heart is, okay? I'm really doing this to show you how dishonest these people are. So here is my first statement. When I heard about Charlottesville, and I have a home in Charlottesville, a lot of people don't know. Here's what I said on Saturday. We're closely following the terrible events unfolding in Charlottesville, Virginia. This is me speaking. We condemn in the strongest possible terms this egregious display of hatred, bigotry, and violence. That's me speaking on Saturday.
So that is the 45th president of the United States speaking at a campaign style or rally in Arizona yesterday, Phoenix, Arizona. Rambling, I mean, in some spaces of the speech, rambling somewhat incoherently, seemingly slurring his speech a little bit. I don't know what that's all about, but the general consensus of all the reports that I saw was that it was the 45th president doubling down on the rhetoric from prior post Charlottesville and not calling. I mean, we have more sound. Before we get to the sound, though, I forgot to give our social media announcement. Please make sure to follow us on Twitter at First Edition 88.9, and don't forget to like and follow us on Facebook at First Edition on WEAA 88.9 FM. Go to WEAA.org on our homepage for the latest podcast of First Edition, or subscribe to our iTunes podcast, First Edition. Also, hit me up on my personal Twitter account. The tag is at Sean Yoes. That is my name, S-E-A-N-Y-O-E-S. Or go to my Facebook page. If you have information, insight, or breaking news you want to share with me, I will share with the people unless you don't want me to, and of course I will not. Also, before I forget, I want to thank very much Professor K. Wise Whitehead, Dr. K. Wise Whitehead, for sitting in for me for the past 2 days. Appreciate you, sis, as always. Thank you. But back to the 45th president of the United States. Again, making the invitation to our listeners, 410-319-8888, 410-319-8888. Call us if you have a comment about the 45th president's speech last night. Donald Trump's, some describe it as unhinged, speech last night in Phoenix, Arizona. The chorus is growing of people saying that this 45th president is not fit to occupy the Oval Office. He's not mentally fit. He's not temperamentally fit to occupy the Oval Office. We know that less than 2 weeks ago, or about 2 weeks ago, threatening North Korea with nuclear annihilation, that all became obscured after Charlottesville. But obviously, that's still on the radar screen of so many people, so many political watchers. Let's hear a little bit more sound of the unhinged Donald Trump last night in Phoenix, Arizona.
So I'm condemning the strongest possible terms, egregious display, hatred, bigotry, and violence. Okay, I think you can't do much better, right? Okay, but they didn't want to put this on. They had it on initially, but then when they talked, He didn't say it fast enough. He didn't do it on time. Why did it take a day? He must be a racist. It took a day. So this is me. It has no place in America. I'm talking about hatred, bigotry, and violence. It has no place in America. What is vital now is a swift restoration of law and order and the protection of innocent lives. No citizen should ever fear for their safety, security in our society, and no child should ever be afraid to go outside and play or be with their parents and have a good time. This is me speaking. Here's further. This is on Saturday, the first one. I did this three times. Now I figure I'm going to do it again. I'll be even more specific. So I said, based on the events that took place over the last weekend in Charlottesville, I'd like to provide the nation with an update, because that was right after the event, the first one, right? An update on ongoing federal response to the horrific attack and violence that was witnessed by everybody. To anyone who acted criminally in this weekend's racist violence, you will be held fully accountable. Justice will be delivered. Then I said, racism is evil. Did they report that I said that racism is evil? You know why? Because they are very dishonest people. So I said, and those who cause violence in its name are criminals and thugs, including the KKK, neo-Nazis, white supremacists, and other hate groups that are repugnant to everything we hold true as Americans.
So that was a little bit more of the 45th president's rambling speech last night in Phoenix, Arizona. Many more people calling for or suggesting, arguing that he is not fit for the presidency. But give us a call. What do you think? Is he fit for the presidency? Is he fit to be in the Oval Office? And what do you think about the speech last night? I mean, what Donald Trump omitted is the fact that he declared many sides were at fault in Charlottesville. And then in New York, saying both sides were at fault in Charlottesville. And what he also admitted, omitted that he said in New York, was that there were many fine people amongst the Klansmen and white supremacists and Nazis in Charlottesville. So a little bit of revisionist history by the 45th president of the United States. But let's go to the phones, 410-319-8888. What do you all think? Let's go to Alan on 33rd Street first. Alan, you're on First Edition. What do you think?
Unequivocally, and this is not an insult to the president, he's a fascist. And he should be removed from office. And there is an organization taking up this challenge. And the name of the organization is Resist Fascism. And they are calling for Trump and Pence to be removed from office through political pressure. And they're starting a campaign starting November 4th to build up the pressure to force Trump and the rest of his ilk to resign from office. I don't see any other group out there. All these good congressmen are saying he's unfit for office, but when are they going to say, when are they going to call for him to step down? When are they going to start the pressure, not censure him, not impeach him, but call for his immediate resignation along with his associate, Mr. Pence?
They could call for his immediate resignation all they want, but he's not going to immediately resign because a group says he should resign.
No, but I'm saying they should call for people to come out and demand his reason. They should call for his impeachment. They shouldn't call for censure. They should say, we think he should go. You know, and if enough people, look at what happened in Syria, look what happened in Tokyo, look what happened in the Arab Spring. We don't have to wait for these people to figure out what to do. Trump doesn't care what we think.
But I think ultimately, Alan, and I take your point, and I thank you for the call, but I think ultimately, Alan, Trump is still receiving strong support from his Republican base. And many of the Republicans have been silent. There's a growing number who have called for censure. There's a growing number who have said he's unfit, but the vast majority of them still haven't said anything. And that's because they're afraid of that base. They're afraid of their right-wing base. They're afraid of the base that is occupied by the people that Hillary Clinton called deplorables. They're afraid of the backlash or being primaried by those people that are included in the white supremacists, the neo-Nazis and alt-righters that we saw in Charlottesville. The number, though, is 410-319-8888, 410-319-8888. What do you all think about the president's speech last night? Is he fit for office? Is he fit to be president of the United States? There's a growing number of people that say he is not fit. Let's go back to the phones, though, 410-319-8888. Let's go to Nicole in Towson. Nicole, you're on First Edition. Nicole, how are you doing?
Great. Hey, Sean, how are you today?
I'm all right.
Great. Donald Trump is beyond unfit for the job, and it's so evident to most people. Anybody who can look, who looks at him can tell that that rally he had last night was all about stroking his ego. Mm. That's all it was. And honestly, I think that's what this presidency run was about. I think that he never expected to win, but the more people came out for him, he got energized by the size of the crowds and, you know, these people who seem to accept him. And that's why he had that rally yesterday, because he needed that ego stroking, because people have been on his case about Russia, about his family, about all kinds of things he's done. And he honestly responds more to adulation than anything else. He does not have the American people's best interest at heart. That's evident. He thinks only about how things are going to affect him, his family, his ilk, his people. And that's why he made the comments that he made. That's why when he comes out and says what clearly someone else has told him to say, he comes right back out the next day and tramples all over that and then says what he really feels.
Well, Nicole, let me suggest this to you. What I've heard constantly is that because of Trump's brain disease, they call it narcissism, to describe it as narcissism, that he cannot rebuke, that he literally, because of how his mind is wired, he cannot rebuke people that praise him, that heap adulation upon him. So therefore, whether you're a neo-Nazi or the Pope or whoever you are, he can't reject. He can't reject people who praise him or who compliment him.
I think it goes deeper than that. I think he actually has self-esteem issues, you know, because, again, like I said, nobody responds to acceptance the way that this man does. If you watch him, you know, and you see people who clearly are in his pocket, he is in his element when, you know, when people are praising him. And so, and he needs that, and it's clear, but having him in office is actually a detriment to us. But the other thing is, if Mike Pence becomes president, things will be a lot worse, because Donald Trump is one thing, but Mike Pence is clear, he's concise, and he knows exactly what he wants to do, and okay. I think he would be a lot worse than Donald Trump.
Nicole, thank you for your comments. We appreciate them, as always. Let's go to Valerie next in Baltimore. Valerie, you're on First Edition. Valerie, what do you think? Valerie, you there? Okay, Valerie needs to probably turn her radio down. Let's go to Barbara in Owings Mills. Barbara, are you there?
I am here.
Hey, Barbara.
Yes, I think the president is mentally ill. I agree with mostly everyone who thinks he is. But I also wanted to make one point. All those people that were rallying for him last night, we have to remember that Trump pays people to get in the crowd and rally and yell and get other people excited. All of those people were not true Trump people. Okay. He paid people. He did it during his election. He paid people to hold up signs. And I want you guys to yell for me. And he, this is what he does. And he gets them from places where you get actors from. We're not exactly
extras. Extras. I've heard that, and quite frankly, there is a, I'll say a black gentleman. I'll use the term gentleman, who has found himself at Trump rallies holding a sign saying "Blacks for Trump," and they've flown this character in from different places to appear in certain rallies. So that there's some truth to that, Barbara. So thank you for that insight. Appreciate that. Let's go back to Valerie. I think we've got Valerie straightened back out. Valerie, you're on First Edition. How you doing?
I'm sorry about that, Sean.
No worries.
Yeah. Yeah. narcissism. I know I'm not a mental health specialist, but if you read up on narcissism, it's a very serious mental illness. Hmm. And the mental illness is so extreme that the person never takes responsibility for anything. Everyone else is to blame for everything that happens. Even when they are committing a crime, it's not their fault. On top of that, Trump's adulation is horrific. He has to have people to adore him and to actually worship him. And in the White House, that's not what you're there for. You're there to serve the people. When he speaks to his rallies, he only speaks to them as though they are the only Americans. We don't exist because the rest of us aren't, you know, we're not worshiping him. So we're not Americans. It's frightening, to be frank with you. He's inciting violence in this country, outside of this country. You know, telling Korea that he was going to blow them up, you know, and we're in danger. We're in grave danger. That's all I wanted to say. Thank you.
Valerie, thank you for your call, and thank you all for calling in and making your insights known, your thoughts known about this 45th president, the speech last night, and his fitness to occupy the Oval Office. We never take your phone calls for granted. Thank you so much. But we're going to take a break right now because the Mod Squad is here. That's Taya Graham and Stephen Janis of the Real News Network. We're going to talk politics and law enforcement, including discussions, public discussions by Governor Larry Hogan and State's Attorney Marilyn Mosby and Police Commissioner Kevin Davis about the violence that continues to grip our city. Stay tuned. You're listening to First Edition. First Edition here on WEAA 88.9. I'm Sean Yeo, your host, editor of the Baltimore Afro-American newspaper. In the studio with me are the Mod Squad. That's Taya Graham. That's Stephen Janis of the Real News Network. Friends, welcome back. Good to see you.
Hey, Sean.
Thank you, Sean. Very happy to be here.
Just back from City Hall.
That's right. Fresh.
Fresh from City Hall.
Well, let's go to that story first. Yeah. There are several dozens of protesters who are protesting the lack of policy and from their perspective for people who are experiencing homelessness and other issues. What's going on?
So about 50 or 60 tents have been right in front of City Hall between the War Memorial and City Hall for about a week. They put them up last Monday, as you said, protesting the fact that the city has not been providing services, most importantly, helping people find housing. Mm-hmm. So, you know, from what I've heard, the mayor wasn't very happy about it. Being out there.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, so they made a deal. They cut a deal today. They're taking the tents down. 55 people are going to get intake to look for housing. The ultimate promise is that they will end up getting housing, and the mayor cut this deal. And part of that deal is that they take the tents and they move into an elementary school. I can't remember the name of the elementary school. It kind of eludes me right now. But the idea is that these tents are going to be gone. When I was down there, they were actually picking the tents up and dismantling them, and we're happy that they made this deal with the mayor.
So let me ask you all this, and we've had people who work with people who experience homelessness on our show on many occasions, and one of the numbers that has eluded me is a kind of an updated number on general number of how many people we believe in the city are experiencing homelessness.
Well, I mean, every year the city does a homeless census, which usually falls somewhere between 2,000 to 4,000 people.
Okay.
But as many people have told me who work in homeless, a lot of people, it's not just people who are homeless on the streets, but people who, are sleeping on a couch in someone's basement or, staying in their mom's or not their mom's or a friend's,
right,
extra
couch
room.
Couch surfing, as some of the young people call
it. And that population is much larger. But, of course, On top of the fact that they do the homeless census, which I don't know the exact figures, but I think it was
Well, they say on average now, and these statistics are from 2016, that about 3,000 people on average in Baltimore will be suffering from homelessness on every
given night. And that means street homelessness, where they're on the street.
Right, they're actually on the street. And in Maryland, it's about 50,000 people annually.
Wow. Okay. And, you know, I mean, I don't know how, I mean, anecdotally, Tay and I have been talking about how, you know, every intersection you go to now, throughout the city, there is someone
standing with a sign, needing assistance.
More every day.
Now, one of the things that came up during the conversation with people down there was, you know, how Sheila Dixon in 2007, or I think it was 2008, came up with this plan, 10-year plan to end homelessness. And I believe, and I think from my reporting, that it's pretty clear that after Dixon left office and Stephanie Lawrence Blake took over, there was less attention put on that plan, or that plan kind of tended to kind of disappeared. Mm-hmm. And so you can see, you know, there's a palpable frustration. You had Prisoner's Aid, which closed down, which was a big homeless service. And, you know, I think there's been some neglect of helping people get vouchers for housing and to deal with this situation. So certainly I think there was some optimism, though, because I feel like the mayor responded. A couple people thanked the mayor and said they were appreciative of the fact that the mayor had done this and made this deal. So, I mean, it was in general positive. And I think, you know, they've definitely made their point because obviously they got something for being out there.
Were there other issues, specific issues?
Well, yes,
connected
there were.
To the protests outside of ones connected to
one homelessness. One of the most troubling things that someone said to me was a man who said that it had become a shelter for women because the sexual assaults of homeless women and rapes of homeless women go unreported and unprosecuted, and, you know, the police don't really respond. I didn't have a chance to ask the police about this, and this is just a person. But he said what it became over time was a safe haven for homeless women to come where they could be safe because they're so normally sexually assaulted when they're out on the street. And that is an extremely, you know, disturbing aspect, but, you know.
Well, I mean, and Taya, I mean, I know you've worked with women who from different, literally different spectrums along what we call the life. I mean,
right. Absolutely. And one of the things that, you know, I hope people understand, when there are women who are dealing with insecure housing, very often they are also mothers. So this means children are on the street as well. Mm-hmm. Some of the women who are out there, they are engaged in sex work, but they are engaged in sex work for survival reasons. This is not the Elliot Spitzer level of escorting. No. you know, women are literally, you know, exchanging their bodies to be able to have a place to stay, food to eat, or, you know, someplace safe to rest their heads for the night.
So these issues.
And one other thing people brought up, and I'll just add this, is that, and it was interesting, several people said to me, you know, the city wants to reduce crime, reduce homelessness. Because, you know, they talked about how violent it is out in the streets, how many people are on the streets and how many violent encounters there are and how much it precipitates violence for people not having a stable home can create conditions that you know, make people more prone to violence.
And the thing to emphasize is very often it's the homeless population who is the victim of the violence. Mm-hmm. I think that's important to emphasize.
Right. So that's what's happening down at City Hall.
Okay.
Straight from City Hall.
Also, close by the City Hall, at police headquarters, there was a meeting or a joint interview conducted by The Sun with Kevin Davis and Marilyn Mosby at the same time talking about violence and the fact that we're in a tight spot. We're in a tough spot right now.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Tay and I were talking about this before we got here because we found the questions to be very interesting about the fact that it seemed like there was an implication somehow that by Mosby dropping these cases where officers had tampered with evidence or staged evidence was somehow
a mistake or her fault. That somehow Marilyn Mosby, for example, these officers whose credibility is called into account because of the way they were handling body camera footage, or of course any of the officers of the infamous Baltimore 7 with the Gun Trace Task Force, they have credibility issues. And the implication in this article was that she was making Davis's job more difficult by dismissing the cases of these officers whose credibility had been negated by their criminal actions. So who was
suggesting that she was making a mistake?
I would have to say that it was implied in the question, from the reporter, in the article.
Is that
Justin Bentley was reporting. I mean, it sounded to me like he was saying, you know, how do you explain that? And, you know, of course, I don't even know how you can start to begin to answer a question like that, because
What do you mean? How do you say that? How do you do that? I mean, what is that?
It's simply logical. If it would be ridiculous every time someone would come in, a defense attorney would come in and say, you know, this officer was found on body camera doing X, and the case would have to be dismissed. It's simply a time saver to say we simply aren't going to move forward with charges, you know, placed by these cops on our citizens. I mean, it makes sense. It would be time consuming and fruitless.
But, you know, when was the last time we heard about a state's attorney robbing somebody, or you know, a state's attorney driving around and dealing drugs, or planting
racketeering
evidence, or racketeering? You know, these are police officers.
Or taxing residents.
Yeah, I mean, I would imagine at this point there are so many things that have happened in the past couple of years, it'd be very hard to be a prosecutor in court right now with the credibility issues. And the thing is that what people understand is that, you know, Baltimore's been a big proponent of street vengeance. I'll arrest you for this. I'll arrest you for that. I'm going to take you in. But
because
you still
you
end
must
up
be guilty of
in
something.
Court. And there is law that governs what happens. And, you know, as much as some judges are willing to look almost a million ways, like, you know, based on what a police officer said, there's still the law. And anybody who's been in court knows there's a different reality when you bring a case to court. And of course, any good defense attorney is going to question an officer who's been found on camera, you know, placing
a quote-unquote staging evidence.
Right. Let alone the gun trace task force, which is you know, so problematic and involved so many cases.
In this third case, because there's been another video that was discovered, and allegedly, according to the police spokesman, Smith, that this officer, he volunteered this information, that there was, you know, this staged evidence situation, and that somehow because he self-reported it, that must have meant that he wasn't hiding anything.
Well, let's be clear. Yeah. Every legal expert you talk to will tell you that there is no such thing as staging evidence in the law.
Right, okay, but we did hear a rumor from, I would say, a very good source that there was someone in the police academy suggesting to the officers that you can go ahead and reenact.
Yeah, well, there's something being taught
camera,
now that we have body cameras.
Taught.
You know, take and put it in, and you know, that's it's totally possible because, you know, I just know from my friend Stephen Tabling, who used to teach the law in the training, you know, in the academy, that he was fired. You know, he had given a Fourth, Fifth, and Sixth Amendment test to sergeants and lieutenants, and they all failed it. So it's quite possible. I mean, that could totally be possible, Taya, that, you know, these officers are being trained to do this.
They could be directed in this way.
It just makes it impossible for a prosecutor
to do their job effectively.
You can't do a job when weekly you're having a video of a guy either planting or staging evidence. And then, you know, you have the commissioner pushing back against the state's attorney publicly saying, well, we're just getting used to these cameras. But the cameras don't change the law.
Right.
The law hasn't changed.
The camera doesn't compel you to stage evidence.
Exactly. No.
Unless it's something they invented. Like, this is a new thing.
I mean, the first one that I saw was just so... Mm-hmm. What do you? I mean, how do you?
And the officers were laughing during that first video. They were
and that gives you the sense that they knew that they were up to something mischievous. They just thought it was
they
funny.
Knew they were up to no
they
good.
Just thought it was funny. They were destroying someone's life. That was like kind of what was funny about it. Like, isn't this funny? Watch us destroy this person's life.
And meanwhile, as you just said, destroying people's lives. I mean, it's coming up on 100-some-odd people.
Yeah,
100-some-odd cases that are going to be thrown out. 100. Because of just these three.
And then that doesn't include the gun trace task force, et cetera, et cetera.
We don't know what those numbers are going to look like.
We don't know. We don't. And, you know, you can imagine how time-consuming this must be for the state's attorney, for the prosecutors. Because ultimately, the prosecutor is the one that have to review the case. Mm-hmm. They have to review the body camera footage. And now I'm sure that before they're taking cases, they probably have to watch all this footage because I'm sure they don't want to get caught with going into court and having a defense attorney say, oh, look at this, Your Honor. I mean,
It's going to make it incredibly difficult for them to build effective cases.
So, you know, you're talking about incredibly time consuming. I mean, I think the state's attorney is like a $30 million agency, although I'm not sure, compared to the police department, which has $480 million. I mean, it's got to be straining their resources to deal with all the fallout, and they're the ones that have to deal with the fallout.
So let's talk about the relationship between Kevin Davis and Marilyn Mosby. They, as I just said, they did this joint interview for the Baltimore Sun, but obviously there was some friction there in the context of that interview because, you know, some finger pointing, I guess.
Well, I would say in the interview, at least in the portion of it that was online, that it seemed that they said, we understand that each one of us has a job to do. And that, and, you know, Mosby suggested, you know, I understand that the commissioner has difficult decisions to make, as do I. So I think they were trying to evince sort of a united front of at least mutual respect.
But in the series of body cam, you know, issues as they arose, you know, the state's attorney would have a separate press conference without the commissioner. And then the commissioner would either release a statement or have a separate press conference where he would push back. I mean, there's been
and
you know,
the FOP has been pushing back at both of them.
There's been some tension there over this body camera issue, which is very strange, I think, that the police department has been actually kind of subtly hitting back at Marilyn Mosby about, which I think she has no choice to respond to. And but, you know, there was right after she had, I think, the second body camera, the police department sent out a statement very quickly saying, you know, don't rush to judgment. And then the commissioner had his own press conference about it. And, you know, so there has been, maybe I think this was purposeful that they appeared together. I think it was meant to a certain extent to show the public that they are working together. And the truth is they had to.
Of course they do. Of course they do. But there's also an inherent kind of, inherent kind of friction that should be between prosecutors.
I mean, prosecutors are supposed to have the final say on, you know, on these cases. And they, one of the things they discuss, which is a big debate about how the police department sort of consented to the fact that they wouldn't charge homicide cases without approval of the state's attorney. And that came up in the interview. The police department has shifted and reversed themselves on that. And now they say we can just arrest people. And this was something put in under Bernstein, I guess, because the police are in a very enviable position. They can throw anything they want at the prosecutors. You know, they can arrest someone and make it a horrible case.
Because all that's needed is the arrest and it's cleared, right?
They got the arrest. Well, the homicide is clear, but in their case, you know, look, I brought the guy in. But the person has
now
to clean up the
problem.
Mess. It's kind of like when I send a story to Sean, like, hey, look at this. It's great. And he's like, oh, man, you know, he's got to deal with all the errors and all that. And so, but it's kind of like that. I mean, they have to go and stand in front of a judge and a jury and plead the case. So what do police, and they just get overtime for showing up anyway. So what do they care?
Right. And for the record, when it comes to the body camera controversies, Commissioner Davis has said he does not believe that his officers did anything wrong.
Yeah.
Mosby says it's just a matter of credibility. We're not talking about, you know, the level of misconduct or wrongdoing. It's simply the credibility of the officers and that they have none, and therefore these cases have to be
has been, you know, he's been pretty out in front saying, you know, that this
they didn't do anything wrong.
Right.
Well,
Davis,
I thought he said rush to judgment.
Wow. He did not believe there was any wrongdoing on the part of officers and no one was suspended.
In the case where the cop is in the alley, and
that one officer was suspended, but
I'm sorry. This is in reference to the second video.
This is the second one.
This is in reference to the second
video.
Because
the first one,
commish. But the second one is,
I don't know.
The second
one
is just as weird if you sit down and watch it. I mean, it's extremely weird.
They're both really problematic.
I mean, the guy come in from his location, remote location, ducking down to the car. Then they all stand up and they're like, "You ready?
You ready? And okay, and now we're gonna."
And
go.
You know, there's minutes and minutes of footage of them literally tearing that car apart, looking in the same spot.
I think there's almost 20 minutes of footage of them just pulling this car apart. And then all of a sudden, camera comes back on. We got it.
And, you know, they had this perfectly wound bag. You know, it's like they were watching The Wire or something. And here's instructions on how to wind up a bag with 20 gel caps in it. You know, they bring it out and they're like, oh, I mean, I don't know. You know, you can't say for sure, but wow. If he's defending that.
Yeah.
Well, just another thing that I just want to mention that concerns me in this Baltimore Sun article, I would have to say that it is heavily suggested that what was referred to as the heavy-handed policies of 6 years ago was responsible for the drop below 200 homicides.
Oh, that's a really good point.
And this was a question that he asked. And so Commissioner Davis responded, well, there was a price to pay for the drop below 200 homicides, and it's a price that manifested itself in April and May of 2015. And, of course, he was referring to the uprising following the death of Freddie Gray.
That is a really good point, Taya.
So, I mean, it just really concerns me because if it's thought, well, these heavy-handed policies, they may be bad policing, but they keep us safe.
Mm-hmm,
that is a very, very deadly way to think and can lead us back down the wrong path.
And what Tay is referring to is the VSET, you know, 120-person unit that roamed the city basically without, totally unhinged, without any supervision.
Right.
And employed a lot of the tactics that led to the $5 million in settlements that the Sun eventually wrote about. Mm-hmm. But
criminologists, scholars, police, other police agencies who have done their own reviews have suggested that this is part of a national drop in crime and violent crime in particular.
I hate to be like, I sound like a broken record. I guess just being old, you don't come up with anything new. But if that worked, we made 100,000 arrests a year. There should have been no crime.
Right.
There should have been absolutely – and the homicide rate went up.
When you arrest 1/6 of the population, there should be no crime on the street.
So I don't know if that's true, but you're right. It's good to challenge that assertion because people make that assertion all the time.
Yeah. If you're just tuning in, you are listening to First Edition here on WEAA 88.9. I'm Sean Yose, your host, editor of the Baltimore Afro-American newspaper. In the studio with the Mod Squad, that is Taya Graham and Stephen Janis of the Real News Network. We're talking politics and law enforcement. The governor, Larry Hogan, also had a public discussion, I believe, about the violence that is gripping Baltimore. What do we know about it?
All I heard was that they were going to meet, but I have not seen any public pronouncements about it. Of course, Governor Hogan, you know, has said he would help the city on multiple occasions. Mm-hmm. I think he has balked at some people. There were several. Was it a council person? Who was calling for the National Guard? And I know he said no to that.
Oh, yes.
But there has been, you know, talk about state troopers and the sort of variety. It's very interesting to think about because, you know, the people out in front of City Hall were like, look, if you take care of people and do a better job with the city's homeless population, you might bring down crime a lot faster. How reflexively this debate turns to, you know, what is Governor Hogan going to do? Well, you always kind of think it's going to be he's going to send state troopers. But they talked about that for years, and it never really.
Well, and he said specifically, I heard Hogan say specifically that state troopers are not equipped to deal with urban law enforcement.
Yeah.
Which what they are not.
That's very interesting. Yeah, they like the highway stuff.
Yeah. Let's take a phone call real quick. Let's go to Lamar in Baltimore, who has a comment for us. Lamar, you're on with the Mod Squad. How you doing?
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
I hope this is related to what you were discussing about Commissioner and Marilyn Mosby.
Yes, sir.
I don't think you forget, but there was a time where the Attorney Grievance Commission of Maryland actually investigated Marilyn Mosby based off of the complaint by a particular professor at Georgetown University.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He felt it was his need to now threaten her licensure because she went out of the scope of her powers and attempted to bring these particular six officers to justice.
Right.
For what was clearly the death of an unarmed black male in their custody. So, you know, she didn't really want to dismiss those charges, but by them doing that, you know, caused her to. And then ultimately, now they're still suing her in U.S. District Court.
Yes, that is true.
So, yeah, that in my opinion, that interview that was done was a forced interview, as well as the consent decree. It was a forced interview to say, look, you know, you guys have to work this out. And then the Marilyn Mosby, if you don't show some sort of, you know, collective agreement between yourself and the police department, then we're going to have you disbarred.
Okay.
And, you know, the Attorney Grievance Commission themselves are very racially biased.
All right. Lamar, thank you for your insight. We appreciate
it. Really interesting comment. I mean, you know, it is true. And one of the things that's amazing is that federal lawsuit, you know, suing for, you know, malicious prosecution. I mean, those cases almost never are allowed to go forward, which is, I'm sorry, so people know, several of the officers who were charged in connection with the Freddie Gray case sued in federal court, defamation and malicious prosecution, and a federal judge allowed this. You know, usually a prosecutor is immune from that kind. And now, I'm not an expert in this, but that's my understanding, and it is amazing to think about what Marilyn Mosby has endured just to charge those six officers.
It's almost unimaginable.
Yeah.
What she's endured across the country.
Yeah.
Actually.
Yes.
Right.
From the
attacks
the
from all sides.
Yeah. Yeah. So.
The 23rd. Today is the 23rd. I believe this is the last day that comments from the public are going to be taken for the job of public monitor for the DOJ consent decree. I made my pick last week in a newspaper.
That's Tyrone
Powers, Dr. Powers. When are they going to make a decision? When is the score going to make a decision?
Well, I mean, there's no exact timetable. I mean, the city we should know when the city and the police department make the recommendation to the Department of Justice. I haven't seen a timetable, but I thought it was supposed to be done by September in terms of like when they actually had the final decision. And, of course, as you point out, you know, the powers group has – there was a presentation here at Morgan State. I don't know if we discussed afterwards what happened, but it was a real snoozer, but it was
– Yes, actually.
But you know, I mean, I have to say that in this process, the public has had their opportunity to weigh in, and everyone has shown up to answer the questions. And you know, you had Chief Ramsey, who was one of the groups, I think Exelon or something.
Okay.
And he of course was the head of the President Obama's Commission on 21st Century Policing.
Former cop, former chief,
former
of
chief
Philadelphia,
of Philadelphia and Washington D.C. Yeah. You know, and there was I can't remember the name of the partner from a local law firm, Venerable. And
Thompson,
then there's
Ken
one that
Thompson.
Was so yeah. funny that LBS brought out the Leaders of Bureau of Struggle, the CNA, like the naval warfare.
I know.
But
naval
certainly,
intelligence type
as we discussed, people. You know, I mean, you endorsed him. I can't endorse him. But certainly Dr. Powers' credibility and as we talked about before, in terms of coming up with the People's Plan in 2000 and his continued, I think, you know, ability to be critique policing but understand it is certainly, I think, unique. In Baltimore, that much is said, but whether or not who gets chosen, I mean that would be interesting. I mean we'll see because people were there. I think a lot of them, although I have to say one thing, you never see so many white guys in suits at police reform meetings than you do.
It was intriguing, the composition of the audience.
Yeah.
There was a section of suits sitting there
yeah.
that you don't normally see at these reform
like
real, meetings.
Yeah. You know. What's going on there? So, but I mean, certainly I can say this, Tay and I we have attended two of these sessions. The community asked great questions, and there was a really, I feel like this process could help in the sense. I don't want to be cynical because I always am cynical,
yeah.
but Sean's like laughing at me. Yeah, that's a mild word for it. But it seems like the community was really, you know, that they were responding to the community. I don't know if that changed once they get the contract, but nevertheless, I want to be optimistic.
Yeah. Let's take a quick phone call. Let's go to Emmanuel in Baltimore. Emmanuel, you're on with the Mod Squad. How you doing?
How you doing there?
All right.
Good evening.
I just wanted to comment on this Marilyn Moseley thing. I mean, y'all made some good points, but, you know, it goes to show that when you speak truth to power and you have nobody behind you, then power always wins, whether they're right or whether they're wrong. Mm. In this case, the community know they was wrong. You know, those officers that took Freddie Gray down definitely injured him to the point where he died, okay? And I take this back even to when President Obama said, you know, for our people, you know, get up off your couch, get involved. This is what happens when you don't get involved. Mm. The powers to be keep winning.
Okay.
You know, and it's one of them things where, you know,
that is a good point.
March for us to get where we're at. We need to march to stay where we're at.
Mm.
Very true.
All right. Emmanuel, well, thank you for your call.
Emmanuel's perfectly right, because if Marilyn Moseby hadn't been elected, hadn't been Greg Bernstein,
That's
I think
right.
we can pretty much consider that the officers would have been charged. And regardless, that has changed things.
Certainly.
I think in a fundamental way. Go ahead.
I was just going to mention, I had seen an op-ed written by Bernstein recently published in the Baltimore Sun, and one of the things that he had called for was mandatory minimums for illegal gun possession in Baltimore. So you can tell that he has, if he was still in charge, things would have been
I would argue that
different.
In the 15 years since I've covered Baltimore City, Marilyn Moseby's election was the most...
This was a stunning upset and a real sign
and
that people
really
want change.
And was the
in
thing
Baltimore.
That actually brought change, other than the council election where you have 8 new council members, but certainly that was the beginning of change transforming the city that, you know,
yes.
we're still seeing how it's going to play out.
I don't think we'd see any of the steps towards police reform without Marilyn Moseby having done what she's done.
No, I don't think
but
so.
But even with the election of Marilyn Moseby, even with the election of these 8 new council people, we see just how recalcitrant, you know, the system is.
Right.
We see how dug in it is.
It's amazing.
The resistance is still, it's almost impossible to gauge.
They're impervious to the idea of professionalism in the police department because anyone would say that wasn't professional. You know, to say that I can stage evidence, these things are crazy. This any other city where the law governs how you operate would say it was insane. But people are supporting that idea. And they're supporting the idea that they can continue to make these horrible cases that really don't make the city safer and just, right. you know, beat up on the state's attorney's office for not, you know, following their lead.
No, and I think you make an interesting point that they're not making solid, legally solid cases, yeah. let alone ones that are, you know, just to members of the community. And there have been these recent attacks against the judiciary, whether it's been coming from Commissioner Davis's direction, whether it's been coming from Governor Hogan's office, that 60% of gun offenders convicted in Baltimore have half their sentence suspended. And there have been these
attacks.
And they
all could have been arrested by the Gun Trace Task Force.
They could have all been arrested by the Baltimore 7.
How do we know? We have to start with the credibility of the agency. Where's the credibility?
Can't talk back, right? Yeah, they have to remain quiet. They can't be seen to side on either side of a politician or a political issue. So they have to remain silent. And there have been attacks lodged at them consistently.
And I mean, given the vitriol launched against Marilyn Mosby after she charged the officers, what can she say at this point?
Yeah. Hmm.
We're going to have to leave it there. The Mod Squad is Taya Graham and Stephen Janis of the Real News Network. Friends, we'll see you Friday.
Yep. Absolutely.
All right, very
Thank
good.
You, Sean.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, the second hour, first edition on Wellness Wednesday. Kenyatta Moon is here. She's founder of the Interim Academy for Holistic Thought. She's co-host of Holistic Living. It's all coming up next on First Edition. Stay tuned.